This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. This week on Cadenza begins a four-week series where we'll visit with four extremely talented and very, very interesting pianists doing important things at the keyboard. We'll begin by chatting with the French artist Nicolas Horvat. Not really destined to be a musician, no such family lineage, he actually went to school where he grew up, in Monaco. He was discovered, so to speak, by the famous American conductor Lawrence Foster, who made sure my guest was given a music education here in the States, and then my guest started winning competitions, nearly a dozen of them, and recognition. You're listening to a recording pulled off of YouTube, thereby the sub-quality, of Mr. Horvat in the final minutes as soloist in Alexander Scriabin's piano concerto recorded back in 1995 with the Monte Carlo Philharmonic Orchestra. But he was always one to chart his own path. In addition to the standard repertoire, he performed and even composed some of the most avant-garde music, but also started staging and performing some of the longest works and also longest recitals and concerts in recent memory, such as performing all the works for piano and orchestra by Franz Liszt in one concert evening, or tackling the multi-movement, multi-hour, sometimes up to 30-plus hours, infamous work Vexations by Erik Satie. And he continues to stage these concerts that span hours upon hours. He sees it as his calling, his pilgrimage, and now he is drawing acclaim as he has recorded all the piano music of American composer Philip Glass on the Grand Piano label, distributed by Naxos. I heard him in New York a while back in a concert of music by Mr. Glass, as well as works my guest had commissioned from other composers as homage to the American composer. He will be performing the whole piano output of Philip Glass in one evening or one day in an upcoming concert at Carnegie Hall, and I'll give the details at the end of our chat. Speaking today with pianist Nicolas Horvat. It's good to talk to you finally. This has been a couple of years we've been trying to make this happen.
Yes, exactly. We were trying to make this interview after the Carnegie Hall, the world premiere of all the Fugue de Glace Etude.
Yeah.
And finally we can do it. That's so great. I'm so happy to do it with you and all your listeners.
Before I get into what makes you different from other pianists, I need to know, and our listeners need to know, where the differences came from. So right off the bat, I want to start back at the beginning. I'm just curious, were you born in France? Because you schooled in Monaco. I'm just curious.
Well, I am born in Monaco, but I am French, because this country has a different right for the newborn, mean that if your parents are not from Monaco, you cannot have the Monaco nationality.
Okay, all right.
But I did all my first years of study there. Right. And after when I was 20, I went to Paris to complete in École Normale. And after, I had the luck to work with a lot of great maestros.
You started piano fairly young then, right?
Well, I started, I was 5 years old.
Okay.
Well, you know, my family was not musician at all. So it was like a hobby. Not really a hobby. It was because I was, how can I say? I was very shy as a kid. So the piano was my way to express myself.
You were playing, I think you were around 16, and I think Lawrence Foster heard you, so he sort of helped you. And then you were able to study with a really distinguished line of teachers, or you have them as mentors.
Yes, I was extremely lucky on my beginning of career, and still now, I think I'm very lucky with what is going on and all the projects I'm doing. But starting with Lawrence Foster, the very fun is that, well, you know, I was doing, you know, I was in the Monaco Conservatory, and every year I was like winning the first prize. And it was like a game with my mom. Like, if I was able to win it, she would invite me to a very nice restaurant, but I like it. So it was, you know, the way to push me to practice the piano. and you know, and the funny thing, when I was, I think it was 15, or no, 14, when Lauren went to this competition, because his daughter was there.
Oh, okay.
I practiced very hard. And, well, it didn't came for me. It simply came because his daughter was in the competition too. And so I played. And, of course, since I wanted to go to the restaurant, I really beat her. Because, I was, you know what I mean. And I remember very well, I played, it was Mozart Fantasy, Kive 475, you know, in C minor.
Yeah.
And after when I played, there was this, you know, I was like, what can I say? You know, it's not a musician family. And so, you know, it was like not that important at this early age, since it was simply a communication tool for me. So after I played, I remember there was this, for me, it was tall, like this old man with gray hair. And he was very important in Monaco at this time because he was the artistic director of the Monaco Orchestra.
Right.
And also the principal conductor too. And he came to me and he was like, oh, Nicola, you really play like a professional. It's fantastic what you did. And I will give you a scholarship to study in America. But, you know, my family was not musician, so I didn't believe him at all. I was like, okay, thank you very much. You know, like, yeah, thanks for the joke. You know, that's very funny. And the thing is that when I call my mom, because at this time there were no cell phone, nothing, so you have to go to public phone to call someone.
Right.
So when I call her to the job and told her that I won, and after I say, oh, you know, mom, you know the old guy in the orchestra, the guy who is conducting it? He told me that, and she was like, you know, like, how can I say? When you met my mom at Carnegie Hall, she has a big presence, you
right,
know, with
right.
her voice. And she was like, oh, this is fantastic. She was shouting all the time on the telephone. And then after we met him, and he did a couple of tests. And 2 years after, when I was 16, he was able to give me a full scholarship from the Princess Grace Foundation. And I went in the Aspen Music School and Festival for 3 months, the 10 weeks competing. And I studied with Gabriel Trudos. And this is how I discovered that piano was something for me. And it's funny because it was in America, actually.
Well, also an aspect besides this great break that Lawrence Foster gave you got to study. Like you said, you were very successful in the competitions you entered. I mean, these days, competitions aren't quite what they were decades ago for pianists because there's no recording contract, things like that. But you kind of turned your competition success into the career you have now, because by winning the competitions, if I'm right about this, you can correct me, it gave you the freedom to then explore repertoire such as the Philip Glass that really was a no-no in France. I mean, you didn't program this stuff and play it as a French pianist, right? I mean, the competitions kind of free you up to sort of go in directions you might not have otherwise have gone?
Well, it's not really that way, actually. The thing that competition gave me two things. First of all, I was also, once again, very lucky because I start competition very old. I was 30 when I did my very first competition.
Wow.
And it was totally by accident, I mean, because at the time I was with some piano teacher. I don't even put the name on the record because they don't need to be remembered. So, yeah, but they used to tell me that I would never do a concert in my own life, you know, this kind of teacher, if you know what I mean. And when I turned 30, I got something very terrible that happened in my life. My grandmother passed away, and I was extremely close to her. And just not to suffer too much from the loss, I just registered into an international competition. It was, I remember, the Scriabin International. And I just registered 2 weeks before the competition. Means I was not ready at all. And I was with this kind of low teacher, and he told me, well, you know, if you want, you can do it, but don't have too much dream. But it can be good for you and for your sadness. And the thing that I really worked very hard at this time, and I won it. I was first prize, and I couldn't even believe it. Because, you know, there were all those people coming from Hamburg, because the Hamburg piano school is very popular, and there is a lot of Russian. Also, they were coming from Moscow and St. Petersburg, and also Paris Conservatory, and they were playing so loud and so well. And for me, it was like a big concert, and I was very happy. And, you know, I did my stuff, and it was simply like a catharsis and nothing more. Huh. And there is a very funny story, is that after the competition, I just sit down, and they were going to have, you know, the concert of laureate and things like that. And I was normally dressed, because for me, it was sure that I would not win anything. And there was one of the members of the jury, what his name? It's Igor Laszlo, so that was walking to give the result. And I was down, and it was very funny, because he just stopped at me, and he was looking at me like he has a very loud Russian accent, you know. He was like, but they didn't tell you results. And I was like, well, no. And he was like, well, you're going to play tonight. I say, well, but if I play, it means I have a prize. And he was like, of course you have prize. You have first prize. And I was like jumping, and I was like, but I cannot play like that. I don't have my contact dress. Wait for me.
Run down and rent the tux. From one of my guests' series on the grand piano label devoted to the piano works of Philip Glass, here are the opening minutes of a piece titled Dream Awake from 2003, performed by my guest today, Nicholas Horvat. Thank you. I want to move ahead to this composer that you're recording. I mean, at competitions, you have to play, obviously, some standard repertoire. Many of them have a new piece thrown in here or there. How did you first come to hear, what was the first music of Philip Glass that you heard?
The very first music of Philip Glass I heard was when I was 18. I was preparing the French Bachelor. I remember at this time I was listening a lot of contemporary music because I was working with Gérard Frémy.
Yeah.
And he really insisted on me on knowing things because, you know, Gérard Frémy was working very much with John Cage and all the American and also the Russian. And he did also all the sonata for piano prepared piano. And I remember that the trailer of the special broadcasting, how can I say, the special program of contemporary music in Radio France, there was this kind of French quartet that was very melancholic, and I really loved it. But I didn't know what it was. And it was many years after when I started to prepare some Philip Glass that I recognized the music, actually. But the thing that drew me in was simply a student that one day came with the music, and I was like, well, what is this French thing? It was like metamorphosis. And I worked with the student because the student heard it in, the movie The Hour.
Yeah,
and
The Hours,
so much towards that. And, you know, after a little bit, I was just finding some nice colors in it. And it was at the time, after I won many competitions, that I was trying new program to public to see what they used to like, you know. And every time I play Philip Glass, I saw that the public loved it so much. And that was very funny because when I was talking about that with the maestro I was working on, with some friend that was a musician, they told me, well, don't play Philip Glass music. It's crap. It's not music. It's not contemporary anything. It's some kind of junk pop music. Right. You will never have any success or whatever with it. And I say, but come on, when I played to the public, they loved it.
Yeah.
So this is how it started for Philip Glass.
Yeah, because Glass's music wasn't played often in France, and it wasn't known that well. Now, did you start, because I have to work up to the length of what you've brought these, did you start just programming some of his music in your recitals mixed with other composers, or did you?
Yes.
Okay, you did.
Yes. Yeah. But I mean, it was not only Philip Glass. I will also answer one of your first questions that I totally skipped, unfortunately. It's how I discover all this new music that normally few people are playing. And, you know, it's also very funny because it links with my career, with a little bit different, I will say. Like I told you, I got this first competition won at 30.
Right.
I mean, from 20 to 30, I didn't do that much thing because the people were not trusting my pianism and myself. So what I was doing at this time, I cannot say I was a successful composer. That was not really true. But I was doing a lot of electroacoustic composition. And I was working with François Bayle, with Gérard Genesi. And also my music was played in Radio France once. And also it was selected for the 80th birthday of Parmigiani. And thanks to that, I was able to get introduced to many, many composers that nobody played.
Right.
I mean, because I was really linked with the avant-garde and all the young of France. And when I saw all this music that normally in my school, it was even forbidden to play. I mean, if you wanted to have success in École Normale competition, you should have played, I don't know, let's say, Stockhausen. Well, I love Stockhausen, but it was more like Messiaen, Poulenc, you know, this kind of not really avant-garde. And I personally discovered all those composers. And, you know, I didn't know their real value because nobody was playing them in my country. So what I simply did was simply I was making a selection of what I think was was interesting for the public. And I let them choose by talking with them to see their feedback and see how much they will upload. And after the one that were uploading the most, they had more space in my repertoire. I mean, everything I play, the public would choose it.
Right. So at that time, and you continue to play many different composers and many different new works, the fascination, if you'll use that word, with the music of Philip Glass turned into not only concert projects you would present, but also recordings, the series, these volumes. We'll get to the length of what you do with Philip Glass in a second, but the content of what you do with Philip Glass, you approached it on the recordings and concert by his etudes, which you can talk about, but also there are transcriptions of some of his works. Then you wished to augment the whole thing here by going to other composers and commissioning works from them that would stand as companion pieces to Glass's etudes. So that's three different areas you're approaching Philip Glass's music here. So talk about those. Yeah.
Exactly. This is that.
Talk about first your discovery of the etudes. And Glass has composed these over a whole span of years. He didn't just sit down and write a whole book of etudes. And then transcriptions of his works, and then also the commissioning project.
Okay. So the etude was, of course, was part of Philip Glass' repertoire for a little time. But, I mean, for quite a little time, I mean.
Yeah.
And they were very interesting because for the first time he was really putting all himself into piano. Because before the etude, we have very nice pieces like Metamorphoses, but most of them were transcription of other pieces for orchestra or for movie music. And for the very first time, he was putting all his heart exactly like he'd done with the concerto. And what was very interesting with the etude is that it really spawned all his years of creation. And you can see from the very beginning until what is becoming now. Like, I really have the feeling that, unlike all the people believe, that if you approach also the last etude, the 20th, and also if you listen to the 10th symphony, I didn't listen to the last opera, unfortunately, yet.
Right.
But if you listen also to the double piano concerto and to the second cello concerto, you can see that there is some new Philip Glass emerging. There is like a mixture of everything that he was believed, like in Schubert, in Bruckner, mixed into all these years of creation. And something new is coming with Philip Glass, and I'm really looking forward to these new pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But the etude, I try to play them in a different way, because I really do think that, and this is how I approach my recording of Philip Glass piano music, and was the entry, because normally everybody is playing Philip Glass like with, how can I say, the minimalist touch, minimalist trend, mean with a very as few feeling as possible,
right,
to make something really hypnotic.
Right.
And you know, it was the trend of the Fluxus way and all the very beginning of the minimalist. And also it links to the first organ recording of Philip Glass. So it's like a tradition of minimalism. And when I start to study Philip Glass music and I was playing it, I was, of course, playing exactly in this way too. And what came as a shock to me is when I finally went to one of his recitals in France, and I discovered how much Philip Glass was not playing his music like that at all. He was much more like, you know, a jazz man improvising on fixed note music, notation music.
Right.
And he was like putting rubato and crystal touch and some bravura time and also romantic touch. Also, there was etudes that were amazing because, unlike the recording he made at this time, that is a little bit, I don't know, how can I say that? A little bit cold.
Yeah.
I mean, the recording he did is a little bit cold. It's totally different from the concert, but I can understand also that because he did the recording in 2000, and now he's playing them in 10 years after. So, of course, you know, he was able to play them in all the world and to experience different approach of them. So, of course, it enhanced his piano playing also. And so I got this other idea that how Philip Glass will turn if I will try to play not like the tradition, but like him, actually. So what I'm doing is my concept of the Philip Glass recording started to this questioning how Philip Glass will play his own music with the touch he has now if he had a full technical power ability of someone who is 30 years old.
Right, which would be you.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And this is how I started to work with this. And it's also very funny because now you're really able to listen to it, that my recording is so much different from the video recording I put on YouTube. Because YouTube was the very first time I played all the Philip Glass piano music, and after I got a lot of experience. And, you know, it was in Paris for the Nuit Blanche 2011, and I got so much success that at this time Naxos contacted me to and offered me this opportunity to record it. And part of the deal was not to publish any more YouTube recording. So it's very funny because thanks to that, now I'm also able to see, you know, when I read a journalist comment, when the journalist really listen to my recording or if they simply jump to the YouTube recording because they are totally different things.
Yeah. You can catch them. But
exactly. It's
so,
not very nice, but it was part of the deal with Naxos.
Volume 2 of my guest, Nicholas Horvat's series of recording the complete piano music of American composer Philip Glass. This disc is devoted to Mr. Glass's etudes, composed over a span of years and divided into books containing 10 etudes each. This is number 6 from Book 1. Thank you. So you've built this repertoire then of performing Glass. How did the commissioning idea come where you would approach composers of many different styles, but also many different ranks of recognition and all that, that you would approach composers then to write a companion piece to these?
The thing that it all started in 2010 when I first wanted to make a Philip Glass festival in Monaco. Unfortunately, the festival couldn't happen because, you know, it was the time when the big crisis touched France, and especially Monaco, and all our sponsors fled away, unfortunately. But I got this idea to make something really wonderful for this composer that I really think is really worthwhile such recognition. And at this time, you know, since I played a lot of contemporary music, I wanted to make something more lively. And I was asking my friend, who was a composer, to write music. And some of them did. And I got some pieces. And unfortunately, the festival didn't happen. I played their music. And after, years after, it was in 2013 or 2014. I forgot.
Yeah.
I think it was 2014. It was when Palit Tokyo asked me to do again a complete Philip Glass in Paris. I was like, well, but I did it only some years ago. I cannot do it a second time because the public won't like it. And I got this idea that jumped out of nowhere. And I remember this project that I had many years ago in Monaco. And since at this time I knew much, much composer, I simply told them, yeah, I have this big concert in Palais de Tokyo. And would you like to participate and write homage?
Right.
And the funny thing is that, you know, I was ordering composer and they were telling them to their friend composer. And it started with 20 pieces. It jumped to 40. It jumped to 80. And at the time of the concert, I was at 96 composition and 96 homage. And after it came to 120.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, 23. I don't know exactly the number, but it was amazing.
Yeah.
Every time, you know, when they approached me, they were like, well, what kind of homage do you want? And I was like, well, you know, I really like your music. And even the one that didn't know that contacted me, I was trying to listen to it. And I told them, well, you know, what I want is not a copy of Philip Glass, because we all know that a copy is always less good than the original.
Right.
What I wanted and my goal as homage to Philip Glass is that when I will play the music, I will see like the composer eyes on Philip Glass music.
Right.
I don't know if I am clear with that.
Yeah, yeah. You want their view, their take on Philip Glass, but
exactly.
you want them to stay true to themselves in these homages.
Exactly. Something
yeah.
totally unfiltered.
Yeah.
And like that, I was able to have a full range of all the 21st century scope of music.
Yeah.
I mean, there were everything, like from post-serialism to Britism to electroacoustic and piano to post-minimalist. There is a Persian fugue. Also, there is graphic notation. There is also Balian carnival and Japanese, some kind of gagaku music. And it's really incredible.
I mean, I heard the Carnegie Hall concert, you intersperse these with the Glass. Are there plans that these will eventually be recorded or...?
Well, there was a plan, but the problem is it's extremely big.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there is like, I think, 6 hours of music. So it's a lot of CDs. And first of all, I know that Naxos was interested, but the idea is first to finish the complete Philip Glass.
Right.
And after, maybe to record the composer. But we talked about that 2 years ago. So I don't know now what is going on, and especially that now I discover also many Estonian wonderful music, and I am exploring that. And this is also the next recording we are now working on with Naxos. Now I'm building also one composer that I totally found out of nowhere that was one of the big star. Maybe he was the most important composer in Estonia, much before the Avro Pärt trend. And he was totally forgotten and put aside of everything because he was a rank up in the Soviet system. So when the country was totally free, it was like 10 years totally forgotten to play his music.
Who the composer is?
His name is Jan Rets. It's R-A-A-T-S.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I know his music, yeah.
And I'm really working very hard to bring back this composer. So now we are already start to record one album that will be released normally in 2017. And now I know I commissioned him a sonata. It should be ready soon. And also we are working on concerto and also many, many other things and many other composers like Kervit or Tür and also Hermann. It's also the next thing.
The Philip Glass series, volume 4, how many more volumes will that be? Do you know the Philip Glass?
Well, normally the first set is to be 5 volumes.
Okay.
Maybe we are going to work on more volume.
Okay.
I still don't know. But normally, first batch is 5. And I thought we will see later if we can make more.
Okay. Now, you said how the homage project got huge and big. this is where you sort of step beyond where other pianists will go. Because speaking of huge and big, you have put on these marathon concerts, 10 hours plus, and you went completely out of your mind in 2009 with a 35-hour concert. Many people say, what do you play for that long? Well, of course, there is the infamous piece in the repertoire by Erik Satie, The Vexations,
yes,
which is 20 hours plus, and it's been performed that way a number of times.
Yes.
So you included that plus 15 more hours of music.
Well, not at all. You know, when I did the 35 hours, it was only Erik Satie.
Oh, it was just The Vexations. Oh, you stretched it out to that long.
Yeah.
But you've done these marathon concerts just logistically on this. Well, first of all, why? But then also, I mean, just from your standpoint, your stamina, having to eat, do other bodily functions, cramping, staying awake, all that comes to mind of questions we'd want answered. Talk about how you get through these and what's on these concerts and why you did them.
It's very funny because it started totally by, I will say, chance in a way. I started with Vexation because normally I play Vexation for benefit concerts. And at the time I really wanted, because I had a lot of friends and very close friends in Japan, you know, when there was a big earthquake.
Right.
And I did a big tour with Erik Satie Vexation. It was Vexation for Japan. And I played them like 6 times in a row in different places, like in Prague, in Monaco, in Paris, in Perpignan. And when I was in Prague, I had an opportunity to play like a 5-hour concert. You know, this room for 5 hours. I remember it was in 2011. And I had at this time many composers that sent me pieces, and I couldn't play all of them because, well, you know, at this time I was really playing a lot of classical repertoire and I was not known for contemporary music.
Right.
So every time I was adding only 15 minutes of new music in all my recitals. But I got hours of new music because, of course, composers were very happy and they were sending more and more music. And when I arrived in Prague and they told me, oh, yes, if you want, you know, if it's more than 2 hours concert, it's no problem because we rent it for 5 hours. I say, okay, so we'll play for 5 hours. And I bring all the contemporary music that I couldn't play, and I play all the composer at once, you know. And like that, everybody was so happy. And after, I was able to do that 2 years in a row in Collioure because I had a piano festival. It was not really clear. And the night after, I called that the night of piano music.
Yeah.
And I did one also in Kiev with a very big success, but that was a very strange concept because also the night of piano music in Kiev happened at a very, very terrible time in the country. It was in 2014, and it was in February, and it was exactly at the time, you know, when there was a big bloodbath.
Yeah, yeah, wow.
And I played there, and I think, you know why I was, how can I say, I didn't want to cancel the concert because it was the national premiere of Avro Pärt's Lamentate with orchestra. It was my big concert that I love, the night of piano music, and I got free recital. And I didn't want to cancel that, and I couldn't believe that such thing will happen. So one day it was like, you know, I was maybe one of the very few artists that was coming in Prague to play because everybody was canceling. And for them, it was like act of heroism. But I say, well, but I'm simply a musician. Come on. I'm simply doing concerts.
Yeah.
But to return to the large concert, there is also one that get unnoticed, unfortunately, because I got very few success with it. It was a complete Erik Satie. And it was the very first time I did a complete composer. It was not Philip Glass. It was in 2010, I think.
Yeah.
Because the Honfleur invited me for a concert. And I told them that if they wanted, because I did already the Vexation the year before for benefit, I told them that if they wanted, I can do for their big benefit concert. I could play all Erik Satie at once. So I did it. And I started like that.
Wow.
But the main idea came from one book I used to love reading when I was a kid. It was, maybe you know, The Art of Piano Playing from Neuhaus. Heinrich Neuhaus, he was, you know, the teacher of Richter and Diels.
Right.
And also Gérard Frémy, my first big maestro, was also his assistant in Moscow. And Neuhaus always used to say that if you want to understand very well a composer, you have to play all his music. And for me, that was the start of everything. Because I wanted to understand Erik Satie, so I played all his music. And if I wanted to play it well, I played in concert. I did like one big concert with all Erik Satie. And I did in Honfleur, it was Vexation and all Erik Satie. It was 19 hours long. And the day after, I took a train. In south of France, I played all Erik Satie without Vexation. It was plus 10 hours. And after that was it. I mean, unfortunately, there were not a lot of public. But I got the idea in mind. And after I got, you know, the Philip Glass festival that I wanted to do, and I was thinking, well, let's do it with Philip Glass because his music is fitting it very well. And festival didn't happen, but I got a good friend that was who is also organizer of Alter Minimalism Festival. And when I was talking to him, it was Alvin Curran that introduced him to him. And I told him that I got this concert, and unfortunately it never happened. He told me, well, you know, if you want to play it, we can do it in Paris. And in Paris, I got such a tremendous success that it started like that.
So here again, taken from a video posted on YouTube from a performance of Eric Satie's piece called Vexations, for which each performance length varies. This particular occasion was recorded at the Studio Ruby in Prague in 2011 and lasted 14 hours. Here are a few minutes of the final variations performed by my guest today, Nicholas Horvat. Stick with you here. So answer some of my logistic questions. When you're doing these concerts that are this long,
yes,
you don't eat?
I eat extremely few. But if for the vexation, I don't eat at all. No, this is not true. I eat extremely few for the vexation, but for the concert, normally I don't eat. When it's 12 hours, it's okay. It's 20, I need to eat, but it's extremely few because if you want to stay that long on stage, especially for the vexation, I'm doing a special diet when I totally stop to eat any kind of food or any kind of drink for 3 days.
Wow. That's preparation.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, I don't mean to be off color here, but I mean, if you have to do normal bodily functions like go to the bathroom, mm-hmm. everything, you just have to take a break and do that? Or do you...
I don't do break.
Okay. You get no cramping, no muscle cramping or anything from playing this long? Or
well... When I did my very first vexation in 2010,
yeah.
or 29, I forgot, because I don't have my my concert schedule in front of me,
right.
I really had big cramps.
Yeah.
I remember it was after 5 hours, I started to have, I think my right arm was really crampy, had a big cramp.
Yeah,
I could hardly move it. I started to have also cramp on my foot. And, you know, vexation is 16 to 18 hours long, and at 6 hours, it was already a very bad beginning. You know, I was like, oh my gosh, I will be able to continue in this way. And after this time, I realized that if I wanted to continue, I was obliged myself, while continuing playing the piano, to be able to unlock all my muscle by thinking, you know. Because I got this huge collection when I was still student of a book about piano playing, because I used to love to collect that. And there was one, I forgot her name, it's one of student of Liszt that was explaining a lot of things to unlock the muscle. And when I was playing the vexation, I was able to enter inside my own body and slowly by slowly able to locate the cramped position and to slowly relax all my muscle and to put away all the tenses. And this is a very funny thing, is thanks to vexation, my piano technique totally changed. So I was able to continue to play without any cramp because I was able to relax on every muscle.
Okay, just the human feat of you doing this is really amazing. The audience at all these concerts, whether you're playing Satie, whether you're playing Glass, they are free to get up and go as you wish.
Of course.
Right.
Completely.
Yeah.
And even for the Philip Glass, you know, vexation, there is no stop. So,
right. Yeah.
You know, but it's a very special piece. It's very hard to understand also for the public. But for the Philip Glass, I don't do any break at all.
Right.
I mean, there is no time for upload because I'm jumping from one piece to another. I simply put the pedal on,
right,
and after I continue with the next piece without any break. So like that, it makes like a huge continuum of sound, like a huge cathedral. And it's also linked to something I experienced when I was a kid. It was my first listening to Mission 20 Riga of Enfant Jésus.
Right.
You know, it's extremely long. It's like 2 hours something.
Mm-hmm.
And I was simply lay down in my bed and I was listening to it. And this is how I discovered that if you lay down, you're able to experience music in a totally different way. So this is what I'm trying to redo with this very long concept. Actually, I don't like very well the word marathon because it's linked to sport. And you know what I mean? I'm not a sporting kind of person. And what I try to do is something really linked to art. And so normally I found last year a new denomination of those concepts, because maybe you saw that on internet. Since last year I started to do the Santiago pilgrimage. And when I did it, after a few days, I realized that the experience of doing pilgrimage was exactly the same as doing this very large concert. So now I totally changed the name and I call them the musical pilgrimage.
Right. Yes.
So like that, it also enables a spiritual content of the music and not linked of the performance itself. Because performance is only a way to let the music flow for a very long time. And it's only that, nothing more.
Right. And you've got, as you mentioned, there's blog listings of you documenting your trips to Santiago de Compostela and things like that on these pilgrimages. And it also harkens back, like Terry Riley on the West Coast used to do these all-night concerts type of thing,
yeah,
that type of aesthetic.
Exactly.
Now, Philip Glass has never attended one of your concerts.
Yeah, unfortunately, no.
Okay.
I would love him. So I try to invite him a lot of times, but
yeah.
Well, I hope someday he will come. But, you know, he's also very busy as a composer and also as a performer.
Right.
So he's always everywhere. So
he's also over 70, so, you know, it could be.
Well, he's very soon 80, actually.
Yeah, it's true. When you do a quote unquote normal length
yeah,
recital, does it feel weird or do you just you just switch your brain and that's what you do for?
Oh, not at all. I'm playing music.
Yeah.
But, and you know, I'm simply sharing with the public, and that's it. I mean, be 2 or be 20 hours for me, it's almost, I won't say it's the same, but you know, the communication with the public is there, and this is the most important.
And you also, we should say, not length, but sort of the completest thing, like you did all the Satie and you did all the mm-hmm. Glass music. You've done this, like in concert, you've done all the 5 pieces that Franz Liszt wrote for piano and orchestra. You've done them all on a concert. That idea of bringing all this together so people can experience a composer in that type of way. That's you know, I've had organists on that have done those long concerts of all the music of Bach and things like that. So these are really special events. And I bet the people that go, whether they stay and leave, whether they stay and maybe nap for a little while and then whatever, however they experience it, when they come out at the end, I think it's something that they'll always remember. That's what you've given them.
Yeah.
You've given them an experience that they'll always remember, you know?
And also, I just remember something that also pushed me to do this concert at first is, all the concert I did is concert that I was dreaming to see.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, with Terry Riley and also all what John Cade was doing and also Anton Rubinstein with the historical concept and everything. It's part of the historical memory, you know, of books and everything.
Right.
And I was, you know, waiting someone to do that, and I was waiting and waiting and waiting, and nobody ever did it. So one day, I was simply tired of waiting, and I did them myself. And there is a very funny thing. It's, you know, after the first time I was doing those concepts, you know, they were probably coming to greet me and congratulate me. And every time I was telling them, like, I was like, well, you know, you're very lucky because what you saw, this is a concept I dreamed to see one day.
He fulfilled their dreams.
And this is true, you know.
Yeah. Well, we look forward to finishing the glass on recording. You're now starting to record the music of Erik Satie as well, and bringing more concerts here to the States, whether in New York, and maybe we'll be catching one of these musical journeys. That's what you call them? Musical pilgrimages.
Yeah, musical pilgrimage. Yeah,
maybe we'll catch one of these in our area, or maybe you'll stage one. So that'd be great.
Yeah, there is something not, I'm going to say programmed, but we are in negotiation for something in the area in January. I cannot say much because it's still at the early stage of negotiation. But if everything going well, you will be able to experience a complete Philip Glass somewhere around New York.
Okay, we'll look forward to it. I close all my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. And the first question is it's a hypothetical, which says that if you could chat, like we've been chatting, with someone from the past, someone you never had a chance to talk to but could, what's the first name that pops into your head? When I said that question, what was the first name of somebody you'd love to have had a chance to talk with?
Well, I know that the first person that come in mind is Franz Liszt because he was so much generous and did so many things. And when I'm thinking about which question I can ask him, I think I will be so much intimidated that I will simply let him talk and I will listen like I'm listening to a priest or whatever. And this is my first thought. Otherwise, maybe if I'm able to ask question, by example, to Bach, I will ask him what was the goal of Die Kunst der Fugue, because I love this piece. Also, to talk about philosophy and philosophy in music with Scriabin, and also about musical content with Chopin. Of course, I would love also to meet Philip Glass, because he's also very
old. Sure, but you have a chance to do that yet. So.
Yeah, I hope I can do that and ask him a tons of questions, because I love his music. Those are the first ones that pop in my mind, because it's really composers that I really love.
Oh, I think
and
out of that.
Beethoven also, I would love to know more about his music. And maybe you saw that it is something I'm trying to do, and I did with the homage. It's also a dream of musician, because on almost every homage, not every composer did play the game, I mean.
Yeah.
But I asked them if they could write some words about their inspiration, about their pieces. And most of them did. I mean, on the 100 homage, 120, there is 90 or 95 that did it. And I think it's wonderful for the future generation because, you know, I put everything online so everybody can see that. I don't like to hold information. Right. So you can really have access to all the data of that. Do that also for the future generation because, like that, if they want to play the music of the composer, they're able to experience biographies that they wrote themselves. Mm-hmm. Like that they know exactly what the main point of their life and also in which way they see their music and how they compose. And I think this is the dream of everybody, to have Beethoven explaining his music or Mozart or Schubert or Schumann or Chopin or Liszt or whoever. Well, Philip Glass, well, he didn't do it quite a lot, unfortunately. He did in My Music.
Right.
But it's quite incomplete, unfortunately. On his last book, he didn't do it at all, and this is too bad. But with all the composers I'm working with, I'm trying to ask them questions to put on my booklet and really to give them more data possible for the future generation. My goal is, I know that I will be forgotten because, you know, it's like that. I'm not a composer or whatever. But I simply hope to put seeds for the next generation so they can have as much material as possible to continue what I'm doing and to put that in another higher level and to put really contemporary music known to the most people as possible.
Well, I think of that group you assembled of Bach, Beethoven, Chopin, Scriabin, and Liszt. I think Liszt would be the most engaging and the most interesting the group.
Oh,
I mean, not the greatest composer, not ranking composer of talent, but of personalities, for what he experienced. The final question's a non-musical question, meaning everybody I interview on Cadenza fills their life with music. You're very busy. when you have to do something that is non-musical, now I know you go on these pilgrimages, but something that can take you away from music, pleasure, relaxation, yeah. enjoyment, what do you do if you need to pull yourself away for a few minutes?
That's a very good question. I read books, but most of the time they are linked to music.
Yeah, music books, yeah.
Well, I enjoy walking, but not that much because I'm not a sporty kind. Well, I see friends and I try to have a nice time. And I also try to also see my family and things like that because, you know, since I'm always a lot of time, I try not to lose the links.
Right.
Also, I teach a lot, but this is also linked to music. Well, it's true that I'm very busy because I also am writing myself the booklet. And I'm also editing all my CDs because I want to really, how can I say, to master all the content of the music. Well, going to museum, I love art. And when I can, I simply try to meet creators of all kinds. I mean, authors, painters, drawers, also graphic designers. Because every time they are very passionate talking and they are so much interesting. And my curiosity also began thanks to them because, you know, when I was still a student, and especially in Ecole Normale, everything was very close. I mean, in France, when you are a pianist, you have to play only piano. And I didn't feel quite comfortable in that. And I got a lot of friends that were totally out of the classical musical sphere. I remember one good friend of mine that influenced me a lot. He's a very successful graphical designer. I remember we spent nights talking about art, about all form of philosophy and stuff like that. And I think I'm still trying to have this kind of, not touch, but atmosphere, you know. I cannot say it's artistic atmosphere. It would be very pretentious from myself. But I think I'm still an admirer of what they did in the 19th century, you know, the salon.
Yeah, the salons. I was just going to say, it sounds like the salon with Chopin, Liszt, and, you know, Victor Hugo.
Exactly.
Yeah, all these people hanging around together.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And like that, you know, because if you do only piano, of course you will think about piano, but if you talk with other creator, other artists, far away from music, you are able to understand so many subtleties of life and creation, and that's how you can put them back in music, and you can understand what is really going on in nowadays.
Well, Nicholas Horvat, thanks for taking some time. I really appreciated it.
Oh, it's my pleasure, really. And really, at any time, don't hesitate. It would be a real pleasure to continue talking with you and with your listeners.
Pianist Nicholas Horvat. You can find out more about him at his website, Nicholas Horvat, NicolasHorvath.com. His series of recordings of the piano works of Philip Glass, all five volumes, are on the Grand Piano label distributed by Naxos, available at Naxos.com. So my guest will be coming to Carnegie Hall, to the Weill Recital Hall, on Monday, January 30th, starting at 2 p.m., and he will perform the complete piano music of Philip Glass in honor of the composer's 80th birthday. Tickets and information available at carnegiehall.org, and I'll leave you with some more of the same. From Volume 5 of his series of recordings, here are the final minutes from Philip Glass's Metamorphosis 2, as performed by my guest today, Nicholas Horvat. And as always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and wwfm.org.